equal time. Another viewpoint, other considerations. Equal time.
Good afternoon. I'm Carl Etner, your host for Equal Time Radio on Mondays. My theme, as usual, is energy, food, and the local economy at the end of the age of oil. Got a great show coming up for you today with a little bit of help from you. I don't have any guests booked today, just your phone calls. We're about 20 minutes past the solstice, not quite. It's the shortest day of the year, and we're celebrating solstice here on Equal Time with open microphones. So take a minute to call in and tell me what's on your mind, and preferably about something related to my usual Monday theme, energy, food, and the local economy at the end of the age of oil. But we don't screen these phone calls. Open mics are open mics. So here are some ideas. What are you doing in your life to prepare for a future with less energy available? How about 2010? Do you have expanded garden plans or other homestead plans? Have you insulated your home recently, tightened it up, or started burning more wood? Have you installed solar panels or a wind turbine? Started bicycling more and leaving the car at home? If so, how's it working out for you? Or, enough about you, let's talk about me. Let's talk about the show. What shows have you liked especially in this past year? And are there shows you haven't liked? Who would you like to hear from in 2010 as I book next year's guests? And what issues would you like to hear about more? Well, I'd hope to bike into the station today, get a last long 2009 bicycle ride, but time got away from me, didn't have enough time, so I took an automobile. But I expect to bike over to a solstice party tonight. If you want to talk about winter bicycling, that's a subject dear to my heart. I want to start by following up on last week's conversation about the climate talks, the world climate talks under the UN auspices. We had Pat Parento from the Vermont Law School in talking to us about the context, what's at stake, how these talks have been held every year, why this year was special, and so on. And lots happened since then, so I want to briefly bring you up to speed on that. But before I get to that, there's burning question that may have been on your minds. How do you pronounce the name of this Danish capital city anywhere? Is it Copenhagen? Is it Copenhagen? I don't speak Danish, but I lived in Norway and I lived in Sweden. I speak those closely related languages, and I had a Danish girlfriend for a while, so I spent a lot of time in Denmark, especially then. I tried speaking Danish with her, but she just laughed at me when I did so. So we spoke English or Swedish together. But as best I can approximate their pronunciation in their own language of their capital city, the Danes say Copenhagen. So that's not much guidance for us. I don't expect a lot of people to run around in English talking about the Copenhagen climate talks or the Copenhagen Accord. So in the last couple months, I've noticed more of a convergence on pronouncing it Copenhagen in this country. But previously, a lot of people said Copenhagen, as in Haagen-Dazs. But the Danes, when they're speaking English, they say Copenhagen. So that leaves me with the question, it's our language, and if we want to say Copenhagen, what are they to say about it? On the other hand, it's their capital city. So which pronunciation do you want to go with? Well, I report, you decide. Tumultuous end of the week in Copenhagen, and I'd like to give you a little bit of, it's not quite local flavor, but this is an email forwarded to me this morning by Emily Maxwell. She's a Northeast Regional Representative of the National Wildlife Federation, so she's based right here in Montpelier. And she forwarded an email from Jeremy Simons. He's a Senior Vice President for Conservation and Education at the NWF. He was over in Copenhagen, and he sent us a sneak peek at a blog he had sent in to Politico, which he expected them to post later on. I haven't checked to see whether it's posted there. That would be politico.com. But before he gets into that, he gives some perspective, which I thought was pretty interesting. He says, to give a little more inside flavor for you, in the pre-dawn hours of the morning yesterday, which is Friday this morning, this email got caught up in the ether somehow, but Friday morning, pre-dawn, everyone went home. The overnight negotiations, which included Secretary Clinton and many heads of state, were dead. A core member of the U.S. negotiating team would later tell me privately that his instructions when he came in, after a couple hours sleep, were to start working on other business. The climate talks were, from their vantage, over. The president came anyway. This is a U.S. person writing, so he means Barack Obama. There were about 110 presidents, prime ministers, and so on there. The president came anyway. He didn't give up, and he rescued the talks. But it was too late for an ambitious plan. He focused on China and worked it for 13 hours, tearing up his schedule to stay and complete the work. This deal would not have been saved without President Obama putting it all on the line. That wouldn't have happened without all the things we have done together to build public support throughout the nation and support in Congress. Just before the 1997 Kyoto talks, the Senate passed a resolution 95-0, warning the president not to go too far. As far as Congress was concerned, Kyoto was dead on arrival as soon as it was signed. For years, they repeatedly passed spending measures to block any spending to work on it. In contrast, President Obama went to Copenhagen with a House-passed bill and a strong coalition of supporting senators ready to deliver. I talked to one Senate staffer earlier this morning about how his boss, who has been critical of the legislation we are trying to pass in Congress and other swing votes, would react to the deal. He said it was just what was needed to move a bill forward. So there's a little bit of flavor at the end of the week, Copenhagen, coming to you from Jeremy Simons from the National Wildlife Federation, who was there via an email forwarded by Emily Maxwell here at the local office of the National Wildlife Federation. So thanks, Emily, for forwarding that on. Have another email from a listener about Copenhagen from Dan Breslaw. He's down in the Chelsea area. And he says, many people, McKibben, Monbiot, and so on. That would be our local Bill McKibben and George Monbiot, a British journalist who's also written books about climate change and the political response. Many people are disappointed with Copenhagen. So am I. What struck me, though, was not the substantive failures these folks have pointed out, all the science and politics, a lot of which are over my head anyway. What struck me was that what I saw when I tried to watch some of the proceedings. I expected a grave and sober atmosphere, as might befit a conference called to deal with an urgent threat to the planet. Think President Morgan Freeman and a giant comet headed for Earth, referring to a movie from 10 years ago or so. Instead, I saw much levity, flipness, jokes bandied about on the platform, dismissal or arguing down of so-called extremists, assurances that all necessary steps are being taken, etc., etc., and in general, a positive mindset that amounted to a mood of casual, self-satisfied relaxation. The whole thing just didn't feel serious. It shocked me, and there isn't much these days that shocks me. I know this is intuitive and possibly deceptive. I would love to be told I'm wrong. That was Dan Breslaw in that last email. What was your perception of the atmosphere in Copenhagen? Are you satisfied with what came out of it? Or what else is on your mind? Give us a call. We've got open mics here on Equal Time. I'm Carl Ettenayer. Well, what did happen in Copenhagen? What came out of it? There's been a fair amount of coverage going into, much of the coverage I saw went into so many details that it was hard for me to keep an eye on the overall contours of what happened. So let me try to give you my take on the overall contours. It was a political agreement that was noted by the delegates. They didn't formally bind themselves to even agreeing on the text there. They noted the text and then moved on. So they agreed to keep talking. The next set of talks occurs next year in Mexico City, 2010. I'm sure that the staff will be working, probably already today, have been working on following up on it, moving forward towards getting something more binding 2010, possibly the next year. They, in this agreement text that was noted by the delegates, they agreed to limit the rise of global temperatures to about 2 degrees Celsius, to less than 2 degrees Celsius, which is 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit. And that was widely reported. What was not so widely reported when I read the text, and the text is very short, it's less than 3 pages long. When I read the text, they said that we're going to talk about maybe 1.5 degrees Celsius being the necessary limit for global temperature rise. That's less than 3 degrees Celsius, 2.7 degrees Fahrenheit. So this 1.5 degrees Celsius was a number that many nations that are exposed to the worst effects of climate change in Africa, in the island nations like Tuvalu, have been pushing for, because they say anything higher than that, the science says, we're going to be, in the case of the island nations, just wiped out. In the case of countries in Africa, their casualties will mount to unacceptable levels. So they'd been pushing for that. They didn't get it in the agreement itself as a commitment, but the agreement says we'll keep looking at the science and maybe we'll revisit this 2 degrees Celsius and get it down to 1.5 Celsius as a goal. So that was the goal in this noted accord, the Copenhagen Accord. What sort of pledges were on the table? Well, as of this morning, I went to a website called climateinteractive.org. That's climateinteractive.org. And one of the nice things about this website is that they take the pledges for reductions in global carbon emissions from all countries, and they aggregate them. And they say, okay, what's the effect of this? And first of all, they take business as usual, and that's if no emission reductions are undertaken, and they say that would lead to, I'm going to Fahrenheit here, 8.4 Fahrenheit degree warming. Well, what are we to expect given the proposals, the pledges the countries have made? Well, as of today, looks like 7 degrees Fahrenheit warming. That's almost twice as high as the accord says that the countries attending the Copenhagen talks willing to commit to. So we aren't looking in terms of concrete pledges, in terms of climate change, a whole lot of improvement over business as usual right now. There's steps in the right direction. What were the big deals coming out of Copenhagen? Well, it looks like money is one of the big deals. What am I reading from here? Well, the New York Times is talking about an initial fast start fund, and then there's something here. I think this is also from the New York Times. In the context of meaningful mitigation actions and transparency on implementation, developed countries commit to a goal of mobilizing jointly $100 billion U.S. dollars a year by 2020 to address the needs of the developing countries. Now, I'm reading actually from the text of the Copenhagen Accord itself. So that's $100 billion a year to be implemented by developed countries by 2020 to help developing countries leapfrog over our wasteful ways of heating, transporting, electricity generation, and so on, to get into a more carbon-efficient future. The New York Times explains that an initial fast start fund worth $10 billion annually would operate from 2010 to 2012. And the European Union has pledged $3.6 billion annually to the initial Fast Start Fund. Japan and the U.S. have made pledges to that fund, too. The New York Times doesn't say how much they've pledged. But where large portions of the rest of the money will come from remains uncertain. So next year, $10 billion is supposed to start going out to help adapt to climate change and also to start more energy-efficient economies in developing countries. Not all of that money is certain where it's coming from yet. Another big deal coming out of the Copenhagen Accord is verification. If you were following the news at all during the talks, you probably noticed that China was being very obstinate about having anything verified. They wanted to make promises about reducing the carbon intensity of their economy. For every dollar or yuan of GDP they put out, they would be using less carbon in the future than they do now. And they had targets for that. But they said, we don't want you coming in and inspecting anything here to make sure we're meeting that. Just trust us. We'll do what we say. And developed countries, the United States in particular, were unhappy with that approach, wanted to see some verification. The Copenhagen Accord kind of split the difference. It said, yeah, we're going to do some verification and those guidelines will be decided on sometime in the future. So don't worry about it. So that leaves that question at least decided in principle. The devil is in the details of the guidelines. Another interesting thing that came out of Copenhagen is international alliances, new international alliances in working on the climate question. Andrew Light, who was writing about this at grist.org, which I find a lot of interesting reporting on Copenhagen at grist.org, G-R-I-S-T. Andrew Light says, there's a different aspect of this deal that could be the beginning of a game changer in how the world looks at ending carbon pollution. The Copenhagen Accord was not forged among our closest allies in the developed world. It was a product of cooperation between the U.S. and a group of the largest carbon emitters in the developing world. Remember, China just surpassed the U.S. in the last year or so as the world's largest carbon dioxide emitter. They're responsible for 21% of all emissions. The U.S. is responsible for 20% of all anthropogenic emissions. So the U.S. cooperated with a group of the largest carbon emitters in the developing world. In fact, Andrew Light continues, this same group had met prior to the Copenhagen meeting in China to declare that they would never move beyond one of the core guiding assumptions of the Kyoto Protocol, that the world is divided between developed and developing countries, and that only the former are required to take steps to curb their carbon emissions and be held accountable for those reductions. This union of the U.S. with these four countries is premised on what could become a new guiding assumption that the world is divided between the major emitters of carbon pollution and everyone else. In that respect, the fact that the accord includes a robust compromise on measurement, reporting, and verification acceptable to both the U.S. and China is significant. That was Andrew Light reporting at grist.org. What else do we have here about Copenhagen? If you want to chime in anytime about Copenhagen or anything else on your mind, it is open mics. I'm Carl Etnayer. This is Equal Time. But I've got more here, and I'll just keep going on if we don't get any phone calls. The status of the Kyoto Protocol was something which was one of the bloodiest skirmishes in what Noah Sachs, also writing at grist.org, calls the Battle of Copenhagen. This is what he says about it. This issue, this is under the category of what's missing at the result of Copenhagen. This issue of the Kyoto Protocol held up substantive progress for 8 of the 10 days of the conference. The negotiators in the end decided on the so-called two-track process, in which working groups on the Kyoto Protocol and on long-term cooperative action will continue to negotiate. These two ad hoc working groups, he says, increasingly look permanent. There's still a lot of uncertainty about how the Kyoto Protocol and any supplemental treaty would fit together, however. Look for this to be a contentious issue in Mexico City and beyond. Again, that was Noah Sachs at grist.org. What's the important thing about the Kyoto Protocol versus long-term cooperative action versus scrapping it, replacing it with something else? The Kyoto Protocol, as you may recall, included only the developed countries, the developing countries, which amongst them China, which is now the largest carbon polluter in the world, had no obligations under the Kyoto Protocol. And out of Copenhagen, everybody agrees to start working on their carbon emissions. Nobody has agreed to any obligations yet. But whether the Kyoto Protocol will remain in effect and there's an add-on, Noah Sachs says, or whether it will be modified or just scrapped, it's not clear. What are people saying around the world about Copenhagen? Well, I figure you get enough U.S.-based information here, so I wanted to take a look at a few editorial reactions in some foreign papers that you might not be looking at so frequently. It's wonderful, thanks to the web, how easy it is to check out foreign editorial pages. And grist.org put together a handy roundup of many countries' editorials in some of their leading papers. Let's look at Britain first. The Independent is a nationwide newspaper there, and Grist says that their editors were perhaps the most forthright in their anger over Copenhagen, leveling the blame directly at two nations. This is a quote from The Independent in Britain. It is important to be clear from where the opposition came. The immediate reaction against Barack Obama smacked a little of a pre-written liberal script, combining anti-Americanism with the certainty that progressive leaders will betray their cause. The real obstacle to a better deal, as Michael McCarthy reports, was China, with India hiding behind the Chinese shadow, in the words of one participant. The U.S. president declared a target for his country of an 80% cut by 2050. We can be doubtful about the mechanisms for achieving it, but not about its ambition. But the Chinese refused to have any targets in the accord at all, not even the targets that other countries were willing to set themselves. This requires a rethink about the realities of geopolitics in the remaining decades of the 21st century. In the economics of carbon, we're back in a bipolar world, with China the preeminent power. China has moved a long way towards its green responsibility in recent years, but the failure of Copenhagen has exposed how large a gulf remains between Beijing and the rest of the world. Unquote. That's from an editorial in the British newspaper, The Independent. Then let's look at the Times of India with what the Grist calls a bit of finger-pointing back at the world's rich countries. Here's the Times of India. What are the quantifiable targets for rich countries to reduce emissions? What is the time frame? How will the UN ensure that the promised $30 billion between 2010 and 2012 and the $100 billion a year from 2020 onwards as assistance from the rich to the poor countries, announced by the US, not by the UN, are deposited in the fund and dispersed equitably? Boy, that's a long sentence. The Times of India continues, the 2010 Mexico summit has to produce a plan that works out the mechanisms involved, including emission targets, deadlines, and penalties for failure, as well as rewards for achievers. With only a token agreement at Copenhagen, the ball has just been pushed down to Mexico. One can only hope the Americans are more forthcoming there. It's from the Times of India, compiled courtesy of grist.org. So that's about all I have on Copenhagen. I do have a version of Jingle Bells that is, this is the sort of Christmas music that I listened to growing up in Wisconsin, visiting my relatives in Minnesota. We had a lot of Swedes and Norwegians and some Danes there, and we had a lot of Scandinavian Christmas music, and this is Stan Freberg and Yogi Jorgensen with their version of Jingle Bells.
My wife says to me, let's not drive the old coupe, hitch up once again the one horse open sleigh. The horse was awful mad. If he could talk, he'd say, you'll be sorry you hitched me to a one-horse open sleigh. Jingle bells, jingling all the way. It ain't fun like it used to be in a one-horse open sleigh. Jingle bells, jingling all the way. I should have worn long underwear in that one horse open sleigh. Dashing through the snow with the cold wind in our face, I can't hold a horse, he thinks he's in a race. He kicks snow on us, it hits us on the chest. I bet that we're the coldest Swedes in the whole darn Middle West. Jingle bells, jingling all the way. My wife sure hates sleigh bells since she rode that one-horse sleigh. Jingle bells, jingling all the way. We're too old for riding in a one-horse open sleigh. awful dark. Can't see beyond my nose. I can't blink my eyes. My eyeballs must be froze. I can't hear my wife yell. I can't see her face. I guess I must have lost her when we turned at the Johnson's place. Jingle bells, jingle bells, jingling all the way. I nearly caught pneumonia in that one horse open sleigh. Jingle bells, jingle bells, jingling all the way. I wouldn't make brass monkeys ride in a one horse open sleigh.
Jingle Bells by Stan Freberg and Yogi Jorgensen, a Scandinavian Christmas. I'm Carl Etner. You're listening to Equal Time Radio, and it's open microphones, and we got a caller calling in. We're going to go to Keysville, to Ken. We lost him. Okay. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back to Equal Time. I'm Carl Etner, your Monday host, trying to get a little bit of feedback from you today on food, energy, and the local economy at the end of the age of oil. What are you doing to prepare for a future with less energy? What does your garden look like for next year? Have you started ordering your seeds, expanding your garden, doing other things on your homestead? How about insulating your home, tightening it up, or burning more wood? Have you done some of that? How's it working out? Installed solar panels or a wind turbine? Bicycling more? Leaving the car at home? You want to talk about winter biking? Love to hear from you. Otherwise, I'll just keep playing some stuff and reading some articles that I came across that were of interest to me. How about nuclear power? I have a big decision in the legislature this year as to whether or not to allow Vermont Yankee to get a certificate of public good and be relicensed for another 20 years. How about building new nuclear power plants? Went to a good lecture by Mark Cooper, professor at Vermont Law School. I think it was at the Renewable Energy Vermont conference earlier this fall. And he was crunching the numbers, and he was saying, I'm not speaking from an anti-nuclear position. I'm just speaking as a consumer advocate here. And new nuclear power plants are so costly, nobody wants to invest in it unless the federal government guarantees the investment. And they're so costly, we have the capacity to use renewable energy and efficiency. There's about, efficiency is the cheapest form of new electricity, new in quotes. And then there's about 10 or 14, I'm going by memory here, types of renewable energy, which are less expensive than a credible estimate for new nuclear. And that means that we don't need to ever build any new nuclear power plants. Well, at least for the next 30 years, he was saying. Well, the nuclear industry thinks differently. This is an article from SeekingAlpha.com, which is not a website I spend a lot of time on. And so I can't generally vouch for its credibility, but they're quoting people like former New Jersey Governor Christine Todd Whitman, who was also head of the U.S. EPA in the early years of the Bush administration. So I assume that the reporting is accurate here. The headline is that the nuclear industry will settle for 25 to 30 new nuclear plants by 2030. Michael Canellis writes, to meet the current goals for greenhouse gas emissions, the U.S. would have to build 187 new nuclear plants by 2050, according to former New Jersey Governor Christine Todd Whitman, who now co-chairs the Case Energy Coalition, which advocates increased nuclear power in the U.S. But the industry will settle for 25 to 30 by 2030, she said. That would be enough to meet the expected growth in demand for electricity in the U.S. while keeping nuclear around 20% of the mix. The U.S. currently has 104 reactors. Although a commercial reactor hasn't been built in decades here, a new wave of reactors appears to be becoming financially, technically, and politically possible, she added. 32 new nuclear plants at 21 sites have already been proposed for the U.S. It can be done. They've done it in the past, building 4 to 5 a year, she said. The first new reactor might go up in the U.S. in 6 to 7 years. We're still going to need baseline power, she added. While Whitman is clearly an advocate, the call to more seriously consider nuclear and even expand the nuclear footprint in the U.S. and Europe continues to grow. Energy Secretary Stephen Chu has come out in favor of expanded nuclear, and so have a number of high-profile academics. Quote, I don't see a sensible solution toward reducing carbon emissions without having nuclear as part of the mix, unquote, said Dan Kamen, the UC Berkeley professor who also runs the Renewable and Appropriate Energy Lab in the school at a recent event sponsored by Google. MIT's Ernie Monitz says nuclear might be the most practical to decarbonize energy production in New England. Skeptics like Amory Lovins of the Rocky Mountain Institute, however, have argued that centralized large plants are riskier and more costly than distributed power like solar and wind and energy efficiency techniques. Rising prices for steel and concrete, not to mention security and waste handling, will invariably hurt the rosy economics the industry touts, Lovins adds. In any case, the debate is on. So what has changed for the industry? First, the technology has improved, according to Whitman. In the past, nuclear reactors were largely one-of-a-kind creations. 95 of the 104 reactors in the U.S. are based around different designs. The industry has moved towards standardized reactors, which cuts down the cost and certification time. There will be 4 designs, or 5 at the most, she said. And then he goes on to talk about other advances in reprocessing and other areas, but we do have a phone call from Dick in Barrie, so we'll go to the phones. Hello, Dick.
Good afternoon to you.
I bet you're calling about nuclear power.
Hello.
Yes, go ahead.
As usual, people painting this beautiful portrait of alternative energy to supply a substitution for nuclear, they don't have the faintest idea what they're talking about, and they don't. There is no way that you can ever produce anywhere near sufficient power by either solar or by wind to supply electric power for anything other than streetlights. They just don't do it. If you do the calculation, here in Vermont, a relatively small area, you would literally have to cover the entire state with solar panels to replace just that power, which is produced by Yankee One. By the same token, wind towers. The most successful country to employ wind as an energy source is Denmark. By the way, less than 10% in the most successful installation is produced by wind, and that is in Denmark. People are kidding themselves. Meanwhile, we are arguing about carbon footprints and things of that nature. Vis-a-vis, let's talk about what it is. We're talking coal and fossil fuels of the other types, which is oil and gas. By the way, when was the last time you ever saw a picture of China and its air pollution problems? We do not have, we made a concerted effort in this country 50-odd years ago to build nuclear because at that time it was the most practical, clean, and I emphasize that word clean, alternative to what we had been employing up until then, which was oil and coal. Here we are 50 years later, and people say, we don't want nuclear. Well, I don't see them making the sacrifice of not having 4 color television sets and 3 computers, because these are energy users. And there's not much way to improve on the efficiencies of them. It's already been done. France, on the other hand, in 1973, made a concerted effort to convert from what had been their primary source of energy, oil, with less coal, and went nuclear. 75%+ of the electricity produced in France is vis-a-vis, guess what? Nuclear. Successfully, obviously, or they wouldn't be doing it.
So, Dick, let me ask you, there's nobody who wants to invest in nuclear power right now without federal guarantees.
That.
So should the federal taxpayers be? Hey, Dick, let me finish the question to you, please. Should the federal taxpayers be on the hook for private investments in nuclear power?
I'll give you an answer which is not what I really mean, and I'll explain to you that in a second. The answer is yes. Now, I don't really mean that. The reason is this. We have subsidized to no living end solar and wind. Wouldn't it not be fair to subsidize nuclear then? I mean by the statement.
Nuclear power has received a lot of subsidies.
The private industry should be sufficiently capable of financing their own, and given the opportunity, if it wasn't for the current economic trend we're in right now, they could do it.
The whole nuclear industry came about because of federal subsidies, and every nuclear power plant is subsidized by the Price-Anderson Act. They don't have to pay for the insurance that nobody would write for them in case there was a catastrophic accident.
Obviously, I don't argue when you tell me the real facts, and in this case, you are telling me the real facts that I'm more than familiar with.
Mm-hmm.
That is correct. That is what it took to get the industry, which is basically very, very conservative. People in the utility business, they're regulated by all kinds of agency from the federal level down to almost to your local. Well, here in Vermont, we have local utilities that comprise little more than a town. So they are very conservative by nature. And in order for them to have made that kind of a commitment, yes, it took the federal government to guarantee or to ensure that, yes, this could go.
Well,
it would work.
Let me put it this way, then. I mean, I guess I won't argue with you, Dick, that we need to have some subsidies for any sort of energy policy that we have. That seems to be the system that we're living in.
At this point, I would say that is true.
So let me ask it this way, then. As I understand it, under the current laws, private investors would not be risking one penny of their own money in investing in nuclear power plants. Shouldn't they have some skin in the game?
The answer to that is you are right, and no, I'm not happy with that thought, and I would put their feet in the fire.
Mm. Okay.
Meaning, I am reasonable.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I built these silly darn things. I built was involved in construction of three different nuclear facilities, one in New Jersey, one in New York State, and one on Long Island.
Mm-hmm.
And I can assure you, they take every possible precaution to safely build and operate these facilities. The one single incident that we had in this country should never have happened. It happened literally because of operator error, and then because of the superior design of the safety system, it shut down. That was in Three Mile Island.
Okay, Dick, we got the phone.
Other than that, there has never been a significant incident, period.
We've got the phones lighting up now, Dick, so I'm going to move on to other callers.
All right.
Thanks for your call.
Have a good day.
You too. We're going to go to East Hardwick now. Nancy, hello. Welcome to Equal Time.
Hi, it's actually Randolph Center.
Okay, there were two. Is there a Nancy? Okay, Nancy and Randolph Center. Hello.
Hi. Maybe you have two Nancys.
maybe.
Sorry. Continue.
Go ahead, please.
Well, I think didn't your previous caller say there hasn't been a significant incidence with nuclear?
I believe that's what Dick said. Yep.
Well, I call Chernobyl pretty significant, and if he wants to find out about it, he can read the book Voices of Chernobyl, where the author spent 10 years interviewing people, and it's just hair-raising to read. I would believe it was at least 100,000 workers who cleaned up the mess have died, and 90% of the others are ill with more than two diseases at once. So it isn't like it's a benign technology.
Mm-hmm.
It just, I think, hasn't had the media coverage. But you asked earlier in the show what our feelings were on the climate change conference.
Yeah.
I'm angry. It sounds to me like climate change is, time is of the essence. And I'm wondering if, my understanding at least from listening to Democracy Now! Coverage was the U.S. offered 17% reduction in carbon emissions based on 2005 standards. And the standard that was used by the Kyoto Accord was 1990. And so if you do the math, it comes out to the U.S. offering a measly 3% reduction in carbon.
Yep, that's what I've heard, too.
And if we were an island nation, I think we'd be thinking quite differently. Our government would be might even be acting, which I call that a pretty pitiful offer. So I'm angry about it, and I'm not sure how much media coverage there was. Democracy Now! Was very informative, I thought. But Amy Goodman said she was the only, I can't remember how it's worded, but I think it was the only worldwide media group that was covering the conference.
Doing an hour-long show live from the conference 5 days a week, that's
right.
Yeah,
and I mean, many people think climate change isn't a problem. Well, to me, climate change, well, one thing it'll come down to is not enough food. That could be big time. But to me, the problem of peak oil and climate change, if you reduce the carbon for the climate change, you're also helping give a little more time for the peak oil problem.
Anyway,
those are my thoughts, and I thank you for covering it, and I'll hang up and listen.
Okay. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks for your call, Nancy. And we've got another caller on the line who we'll get to right after this. Welcome back to Equal Time. I'm Carl Ettnayer, the Monday host. We're going to go directly to the phone to East Hardwick. Nancy, thanks for your patience.
Hey, no problem. That's funny that you had two Nancys call in at the same time.
And the buttons weren't labeled East Hardwick and Randolph Center.
So there you go. Thanks for doing this kind of open mic show today. And I would love to be responding to the nuclear thing, et cetera, but I really want to just bring up something that's brewing that's going to be happening in fall. Preparation is happening now. It's been well underway. I'm on the board of directors for the statewide environmental education programs for Vermont, and there's a conference that is held every year in New England, and so every 6 year it's in Vermont. And we, as a board, as well as the New England group, have been trying to broaden the definition of what an environmental educator or somebody educating for the environment. And that certainly is the focus of this conference. And it's about creating, cultivating, collaborating, really looking at all food issues, you know, farming issues, energy issues, education as far as teaching our kids about the outdoors, but also what's really going on, but also really teaching or connecting with people from 0 to 100. And just that if anyone is interested in helping out with this, we have a great number of organizations already involved, and it's going to be a really dynamite three-day conference.
How can people find out more about this, Nancy?
Well, what they can do, the probably simplest thing is to call me at 472-6185.
472-6185, and we'll put that on our website as well. May we put your email on the website as well?
Yes, you can. Do you want me to do that?
Sure.
Nancy?
Yep.
So it's N-A-N-C-Y-N at together.net.
Nancy N at together.net. And you say
and
you're broadening the definition.
Is we are also launching the creation of an environmental literacy plan. It's complicated to explain where that's all coming from, but this is also an effort to broaden the welcome to people whose thoughts and missions of their groups really overlap in small ways and big ways. And so,
and quickly, when is this conference going to be, Nancy?
Oh, the conference itself is going to be October 21st through 23rd.
Okay, but a lot of planning to do ahead of time. Well, thanks very much for your call, Nancy.
We've already been underway. And
okay.
Then this other one is Everything is Connected.
Thanks for your call, Nancy.
Okay, thanks.
Out of time there. So thanks for calls from Dick from Barrie, Nancy from Randolph Center, and from Nancy from East Hardwick. Sounds like nuclear power is pretty interesting to listeners. Sure to have more discussions of that next year, mostly in the context of Vermont Yankee. I'm Carl Ettnayer. That's it for Monday's Equal Time. I'll be back next Monday at 1 o'clock. Don't forget to check equaltimeradio.com for podcasts of the shows that Travin and I host. Artie Levine produced the show. Thanks for tuning in.
Oil Check-In, exploring the end of the age of oil.
What do people eat when the economy nosedives? Can we learn now, during the Great Recession, from what Americans ate during the Great Depression? Do Depression menus have lessons for the economic transitions ahead, as shrinking energy availability undermines a global economy that we depend on for our food? A 1930s economic stimulus program provides some answers. When the nation went through the Great Depression, writers from the WPA, the Federal Works Progress Administration, documented what people were eating regionally. World War II embroiled the U.S. before the reports could be published in book form. Now Mark Krulansky has collected many of them in a new book, The Food of a Younger Land. The stories are organized regionally. One, for example, reported on the vending machine culture in New York City. It came as a surprise to me that in the 1930s, 250,000 New Yorkers ate each day at the mechanized fast food institutions known as the Automat. The vending machines sold chicken pie, mince pie, coffee, clam chowder, slow-baked beans with pork, cinnamon buns, and more. How could it be economical to use machines to sell things when so many people were unemployed? And who in my post-war generation knew that vending machines were so advanced and commonly used by the 1930s? Krulansky's preface to the Automat article says that the first New York City Automat was opened in Times Square before even the First World War, 1912. Wow. I looked for the reports from Vermont. Roaldus Richmond, born in Barton, Vermont, wrote down some of the more unusual pickle recipes he found. He said that the varieties of pickles people made were almost infinite, and listed fruits and vegetables that could be grown in Vermont, pears, peaches, apples, plums, raspberries, cucumbers, and so on. But one of his recipes was for lemon pickles. How often did Vermonters get their hands on enough of the southern fruit to want to pickle them? Or maybe the lemons were only seasonally available, so people bought them by the case and preserved some for later in the year. Many older people have said that that other citrus fruit, the orange, was a treat they got only at Christmas back then. Cora Moore gives a recipe for pickled butternuts in Vermont, to be gathered the last day in June. These are not butternut squash, apparently, but real butternuts, closely related to walnuts. We still have butternut trees in Vermont, but not a lot. I know permaculturalists who are busy planting all the butternut trees they can because they think the oil and protein-rich nuts will be so valuable for us. I thought the article on beans in New England would talk about cost-conscious cooking. How did people use this inexpensive protein source for keeping bellies full during hard times, I wondered. It turns out that the baked beans of New England originated with the Puritans, who shunned all work on the Sabbath. Beans were a dish they could make on Saturday night, and they would still be good to eat, maybe even better, the next day. James Francis Davis wrote that the New England households of the 1930s still kept to this Saturday night bean-making ritual, even though the religious injunction against Sunday work had been relaxed. So this wasn't a poverty story either. The Possum Club of Polk County, Arkansas. That seemed a promising story about poverty food. It turns out, however, that the club had its origins in 19th century slave culture and poverty, not Great Depression privations. Slaves were only allowed to hunt at night, and possums are nocturnal, so they became an important source of meat for the slaves. They're still celebrated, Krulansky writes, by people noting their black southern roots. And Polk County's Possum Club is an annual feast, not a wolf-at-the-door group of necessity. It's just a feast which happens to feature possum as a main course. Apparently, the writers who filed the reports in The Food of a Younger Land were more interested in capturing regional food culture, which builds up over generations, than in documenting how people ate well for less during the Depression. Still, the articles portray a nation of people who were much more food resilient and self-sufficient than most of us are now. They put up pickles out of any variety of fruits and vegetables. They made their baked beans rather than buying them in cans. And they caught their own possums. Even then, though, not everyone fixed much of their own food. Burger King restaurants replaced the food automats in New York City in the 1980s, but neither vending machines nor fast food joints are targeted at people comfortable in the kitchen or garden. What I like best about the food of a younger nation is the great variety of food that people in mainstream cultures ate back then, and how local much of it was. With lean times ahead, it's good to be reminded about how many ways there are to put local food on our plates. I'm Carl Ettenayer, and that's this week's Peak Oil Check-In.
Peak Oil Check-In was produced by Relocalizing Vermont Productions in association with WGDR Plainfield.